Welcome to David Maister's Business Masterclass, a series of advanced business seminars exploring principles and practices for success in professional businesses.
Hello, I'm David Maister. In this seminar, entitled More Things in More Places, Multidisciplinary and Geographic Expansion Strategies, I will discuss the common approaches of seeking competitive advantage by creating multidisciplinary services and adding geographic locations. Most professional businesses, from banks to ad agencies to accounting firms, have the hope that they can grow multidisciplinary relationships with their key accounts. However, most attempts to create one-stop shopping strategies have stumbled, and even those firms implementing modern client relationship management or CRM programs are still struggling to make them work. To explore why this common and much-desired strategy is so hard and so difficult to pull off, I'm going to examine the issue here from the buyer's perspective, first looking at the case of multidisciplinary operations, and then looking at the logically similar topic of multiple location strategies. Now, the possibilities to make multidisciplinary strategies work should be plentiful. Many, if not most, of the problems from which clients or customers employ professional businesses are inherently multidisciplinary. For example, if I'm going to build a new electricity generating plant, I'll need advice on law, finance, economics, engineering, environmental considerations, and a whole host of additional disciplines. Or to take another case, if I'm going to launch a new product, it makes sense to coordinate efforts across a variety of marketing disciplines, such as advertising, public relations, brand identity, web marketing, and so on. Whenever I have a multidisciplinary need, I face the decision of how I'm going to assemble my diverse team and how I'm going to manage it. Now, one approach, of course, would be for me to seek out specialists in each of the areas I need at whatever institution they may be found and coordinate the joint effort myself. Geographically, this would be the same as taking on the responsibility myself for coordinating my needs in different countries. However, it can be a pain to be my own prime contractor, and I might prefer to deal with an organization that can take responsibility for managing the whole project, providing a single point of accountability. Note that none of this is about cross-selling or introducing separate disciplines to work on distinct projects. That's a different topic with its own problems. You can see my chapter, Why Cross-Selling Hasn't Worked, in my book, True Professionalism, or listen to my podcast of the same name in my series on marketing professional services. We're talking here about the situation where I, the client, don't want separate teams on separate projects. The very thing I'm trying to buy is one team working simultaneously in harmony on my complex multidisciplinary issue. This is different from what many providers talk about. They often seek to gain a competitive advantage by stressing the range of disciplines they have in their company, their menu, as we referred to it in a previous podcast. Stressing this too much can backfire. When doing some construction work in my home, some of the contractors tried to win my trust and confidence by pointing out that I would need electricians, carpenters, and plumbers for the job. They went on to claim that, by the sheerest coincidence, the best plumber in Boston, my hometown, was their company, that they just happened to have the city's greatest electrician, and of course that their carpenters were head and shoulders above any other carpenters in the entire region. The more they exerted the excellence of their own people, the more I came to doubt them. Rather than building trust and confidence by pointing out that they had everything in-house, they raised my level of concern that I would get what they had to offer, which was not necessarily the best available to me in the marketplace. This doesn't mean that there is no virtue in having many disciplines in-house. I might be persuaded, for example, that because your company enforces a common culture, a work ethic, values, and high standards, then the people in your company can provide a genuine guarantee of quality. But to be persuasive, you'd better have some concrete evidence to back up such a claim. I, together with most clients and customers, am aware that the majority of multidisciplinary companies were put together through mergers and acquisitions, which doesn't usually help in the creation of common cultures and standards. Yes, having things in-house should mean better coordination, but we've all been around long enough to know that it doesn't always happen that way. When considering you as my prime contractor, I'm most concerned about your ability to coordinate, integrate, supervise, and manage the various disciplines I need for my project. From my point of view as a client or customer, this is not about cross-selling different services for different phases of an assignment. That's nice for you, but does nothing for me. It's about your ability to deliver a truly integrated service designed to meet my inherently intertwined multidisciplinary needs. That's the justification for your network that makes the most sense to me, the client. So, do I care about whether your services are in-house or you use third-party subcontractors? Actually, not a lot. I care that you demonstrate your ability to put together a custom-tailored team for me and that you have full operational control over everyone on the project. The fact that you share common ownership with other entities is actually a matter of complete indifference to me. Management and coordination, not ownership, is what affects me. On the other hand, I will worry if you end up using people you've never worked with before, so at a minimum, I do expect you to have a well-developed network of contacts or best friends for every specialty I might need to have. Someone you have an alliance with is just fine. Alliances might actually represent the best of both worlds, giving me the comfort of knowing you can work together and diminishing any fear that you are always self-dealing. All this is harder to pull off than it might appear. For decades, marketing communications companies, for example, that centered on advertising agencies, have tried to market themselves as general marketing advisors for their clients' total marketing needs. A few clients and customers have gone for this approach, but the majority have not. In part, this is because the so-called marketing integrators have failed to shake off the perception that they're really still advertisers with a little bit added on. When the multidisciplinary team is seen to be led by advertising agency people, the clients or customers tend to be skeptical as whether or not they will truly get objective advice on the best mix of marketing communications. Clients and customers are also skeptical about whether the lead coordinating agencies actually do have the operational and quality control over the other disciplines, which are usually housed in separate companies under a holding company umbrella, or at best, in distinct profit centers. Whether the subcontractor services are provided in-house or through a third party, there is just that one thing that the key customer wants to know. Whose side are you on? Mine, the clients, or your colleagues and subcontractors? In the next few paragraphs, I'm going to try and address that by posing the questions that a client or customer would have for a prime contractor that could successfully win multidisciplinary businesses. What should emerge is that a strategy built on multidisciplinary integration is mostly a strategy of having superior managerial skill and a superior internal culture. The key to making the strategy work is not the mega move of adding new disciplines, but as I shall try to show, in coordinating fine-level detail. Here we go. Your task as my prime contractor is to manage the project and all the subcontractors on my behalf. Accordingly, I expect you to act as my representative in dealing with everyone on the project. If I have the slightest suspicion that you are more interested in generating incremental revenues for your company or protecting your relationship with your third-party subcontractors than in serving my interests, then you have disregarded a key element of your prime contractor status, and I will begin to treat you like any other vendor, with grave caution. How do you prove that you are on my side? You keep me informed at all times as to what's going on, both with good news and bad. None of this, let's not bother the client or customer with this problem behavior. You involve me in all decision-making, giving me real options and not just conclusions already arrived at. You consult me before doing anything of significance. You document everything so that I feel empowered and in control of everything that's going on. You create opportunities for me to ask questions, no matter how dumb, and provide reassurance about my fears and insecurities. In short, you apply all the principles and practices that I wrote about in my book, The Trusted Advisor. You are a prime contractor when I can treat you as my trusted advisor, not just as a technical expert. Since you are my representative towards the rest of the project team, I expect you to get to know me and my business in great depth. You need to be sensitive to how I like to do things, how I like to be communicated with, and what my preferences are, logical or not. You are my agent in the world of the project, and I expect you to represent me accurately to everyone involved. If I tell you something once, provided it is not explicitly in confidence, then I don't expect to have to repeat myself to others on the team. Your internal communications, about me as well as about the project, need to be both speedy and accurate. Your key role is to absorb all the hassle for me. Obviously, absorbing hassle doesn't mean keeping things from me. If there's a problem or a misdelivery or an unforeseen complication, and of course there will be all these things, then let me know what's happened, what my options are, and what you recommend we can do about it. I won't hold you to the standard of perfection, but I expect you to keep me informed. There probably has never been a complex project where the client or customer's needs and preferences did not evolve during the life of the project. That's what change orders are all about. Stay tuned in. I need wise counsel, not only at the beginning of a project, but all the way through. When trying to win my business, show me the systems you have for communication, control, cost management. Give me the comfort that you are truly ready to manage complex assignments. Discuss with me what kind of reporting I like to have. Let me decide if I want a lot or a little and in what form. And make sure that I can obtain extra documentation at any time. If something goes wrong, I want to get my hands on a complete history of who said they do what by when. I don't want to waste energy and time recreating history. While I want you to run interference for me in dealing with subcontractors, I reserve the right to deal with them directly and personally if I choose. Who knows? I might have a future need for just a plumber, and I might want to judge for myself whether your choice of plumber or other technical subcontractor is someone who I would consider using. Absorb my hassle, but don't try and act as a barrier between me and others on the project. If I want to communicate directly, I will. Do I care which of the various disciplines on the project plays the role of prime contractor? Not really. Being a prime contractor is not about any technical discipline, but as I've tried to show by taking this approach, the client approach in analyzing it, the multidisciplinary strategy, the prime contractor strategy, is about management, communication, organization, and negotiation skills, and inherently involves trustworthiness and an understanding of my business. Don't tell me you have many disciplines. Show me that you know how to manage multidisciplinary things. Now let's turn to the second part of this topic, adding geographic locations as an expansion strategy. What's surprising about geographic expansion initiatives is how common they are and how misguided. Geographic expansion is not what you do in order to achieve excellence. It's what you are allowed to do after you have achieved it. Once you've found a way to do what no other good company can match, then think of taking those new skills and capabilities to new markets, new places, new disciplines. But not before. Many of the arguments we will make here also apply to our analysis of creating multidisciplinary firms by adding disciplines. It's really the same logical problem. The client doesn't want just more locations. The client wants better integration of locations. They're really similar strategies, logically. Unfortunately, the lure of geographic expansion is great, even overwhelming. Companies who are competent, if undistinguished, in their current markets effectively say, well, we're no worse than anyone else in our current marketplace, so let's go to new places and be no worse than anyone else there. They do this because it is actually more difficult to get truly excellent in the business and locations they are already in than it is to go out to merge with new countries or bring in new specialties that you know nothing about. That's called strategic initiative, go somewhere new, and it feels good. And it's relatively easy to do than to cross the gap between we're no worse than anybody else and we're truly excellent. Going somewhere new should not be as high a priority as many companies think it is. Why do smart people do such dumb things? Part of the reason is that there truly is exciting work in these new places. But the amount of work in newly emerging areas is always going to be vastly exceeded by the number of people pursuing it. You probably ought not to do it unless you're really confident that you have a very high degree of success, a high probability of success. It's as if everyone is planning their dating and marriage strategy around capturing the hearts and minds of the latest model or movie star. Everyone's pursuing what is glamorous, but no one is working at the romance of taking care of those they are already in a relationship with. The dreams are glamorous and they are truly desirable. They just happen to be impractical for the vast majority of the people who are dreaming them. U.S. law firm expansion into London is a wonderful case in point. Of course, London is a good market for lawyers. That doesn't take much genius to spot. Does that mean, as has happened, that over 100 American law firms can successfully open offices there? Of course not, but that's what's happened. Almost all, of course, are unprofitable, certainly less profitable than their company's own domestic businesses. The original partners or senior officers are getting, and will continue to get, literally zero economic benefit from all the overseas expansion. What these law firms and other businesses continue to ignore is the fact that success does not come from spotting emerging growth that you hope your competitors have missed. Wow, China's a big market. Don't tell it anyone. Or, psst, I know an Adelaide company that has just discovered that there's great legal work available in Sydney. Keep it under your hat. The point is, you're never going to be able to spot market opportunities that almost all of your competitors will also know exists. Rather, as I've consistently argued in these seminars, success comes not from knowing what's a good opportunity, but from consistent, diligent, passionate execution of the well-known basics of client service, user-friendliness, understanding of the client's business, internal company collaboration, and all the other well-known virtues that are included in every company's strategic plan and mission or value statement. On a trip to Australia, one of the country's major law firms asked me, David, we're thinking of expanding into Indonesia. Do you think it's a good idea? I replied, well, do you have three senior people eagerly looking forward to spending the next 5 years of their lives living in Jakarta? No, they replied. Well then, I answered, your question about Indonesia and expansion is a moot question. Your success will not turn on whether Indonesia is analytically a good market, but on whether you and your people have the passion, the drive, the enthusiasm, the commitment, the energy, and the discipline to make it work. Sure, someone will succeed in Indonesia, but the question is, what makes you think it will be you? It's no coincidence that the most financially successful and admired law firms in both the United States and the UK are firms that chose not to pursue geographic expansion strategies. Their names are Wachtell Lipton and Slaughter & May. These firms, unlike the majority of their grandiose empire-building competitors, have done nothing but focus on being the best at what they do, thereby attracting the kind of top-tier work and premium fees that are the envy of their peers. They don't attend business conferences, they don't, to my knowledge, hire business consultants, and they've made no attempt to build global companies. They have simply focused on the highest standards of professionalism and aim to be perceived by the market as the best. Everyone's trying to copy the expansion plans of the global firms, but what truly stumps me is why aren't they trying to do what Wachtell and Slaughter & May are doing? Probably the answer is that getting better is hard work. Getting bigger is a simple matter of doing deals and hiring laterals. Wonderful strategic avoidance tactics. What then does it take to succeed in new markets or with new services? In conversation with one of my UK law firm clients, a managing partner of a firm just outside the top tier in the UK, he was observing that the US firms entering the London market that are threatening the established UK firms, these new entrants do not yet have sizable businesses. Nevertheless, they seem to be attracting terrific work. He says, it seems as if size is a lot less important than people think. I asked, well, what are these new EU entrants doing that the UK companies' partners are not? He said, they're showing oomph, implying that their energy was the key to their success. Oomph? That's the latest management theory? Well, yes, oomph. Focus on the essentials and just get it done superbly. Read the client or customer's trade magazines. Act as if you gave an unconditional satisfaction guarantee. Insist that everybody put the client's or customer's interests first. Be absolutely reliable, dependable, and a true trusted advisor. And when you've mastered all that, and only when you've mastered all that, take your excellence onto the road. The big city, China, the new sexy multidisciplinary business areas. Go for it, but be sure that you have first made yourself ready to win. This concludes More Things in More Places, Diversification and Geographic Expansion, the 11th episode in my 14-part series, Strategy in Professional Businesses. The last three seminar episodes will focus on organization and management as strategic tools. Today's seminar was based on two recent articles, Making Multidisciplinary Practices Work and Geographic Expansion Strategies, both of which can be found on my website at davidmaister.com. This podcast series is now available for purchase, both as a single episode and as part of a DVD set from my website, davidmaister.com/store, STORE. I'm also pleased to announce that my forthcoming book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker, is available for pre-order from this same location.